that are bringing in more bones these days. I was in Seattle recently, and there's a butcher there that's actually cutting meat, grass-fed beef bones in a way to get closer to the collagen store, which means that it takes less time in the pot to render the gelatin.
So kind of what you're saying is it really helps to have this sort of personal relationship.
Absolutely, yes.
So I'd be remiss, since this is a cookbook, I'd be remiss to not ask you about some of the recipes. So what are a recipe or two that you're currently excited to make?
Well, it's cold this time of year, which is a great time to make your own stocks. One of my favorite is cassoulet. It takes a really beautiful white bean, typically a tarbay bean, and marries it with many different classically confit, duck confit, and it has an arrangement of sausages. It's also, you cook the bean twice. I learned from a mentor, Kate Hill, that the importance of the bean broth is just as important, just as significant as the other types of stocks that are used. In the book, I adore fennel, and I talk about the difference between celery and fennel in cooking. And so I have a cassoulet that's my ode to fennel. It might have a lot of anise going on in that dish, but cassoulet, it's hearty, it's meaty, it develops flavors over the course of a few days, and it is full of energy, keeps you going. It's perfect for the dead of winter.
Now, we were talking earlier, and you mentioned the recipe from that you've been making in Oaxaca, the laksa.
Yeah,
can you
laksa.
Talk about that?
Yes. So laksa is a Malaysian dish. It's a noodle soup, essentially. Sometimes it's served with rice, but in Oaxaca, I have access to coconut. I have access to these beautiful salted shrimp. Then the shrimp are local. They're all of the ingredients that go into making the curry paste for the laksa are readily available to me. I can't find the specific type of lime leaf that I use, but there's another leaf down there that imparts those subtle citrus flavors. And so I often end up making laksa in Oaxaca, which is a curiosity for certain, but it's one of my favorite dishes to make.
Great. And if people want to learn more about you or the book, where can they find information?
The Chelsea Green website. You can also buy the book on Amazon. And I also have a personal website that is my name. So www.rachelmaman.com. which gives a little bit more history about me and what I'm working on right now and where my appearances associated with the book are. So Chelsea Green, Amazon, and my personal website.
Great. Rachel, thank you so much for joining me on The Food Show.
Thank you for having me.
That was Rachel Mamane, author of Mastering Stocks and Broths. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. In a bit, I'll have the conversation with activist Nikki Silvestri, as well as our monthly garden segment with Marisha Auerbach. Stay with us. This is The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Chris Siegel. When we last talked about the garden on this show, Portland was covered in snow. A lot has changed in the last month, and that means there's a lot more we can be doing to get ready for the gardening season. As always, I'm joined by Marisha Auerbach, who is here to keep us on track. Marisha, welcome back to The Food Show.
Thanks, Chris. I'm glad to be here.
All right, so before we jump into the garden, you just took an amazing trip. I want to hear how your trip went to Belize.
My trip was really great. I taught the annual permaculture design course at the Maya Mountain Research Farm. Our course was a bit smaller this year, but we had some really great students, and it the smaller course led to being really tight in a community. One of my highlights while I was in Belize was working with my good friend Arzu Mountain Spirit, who is developing the first organic market in Belize. And she's working on networking with people from all the different communities in Belize, Garifuna, Maya, Mestizo, Creole, so that everyone who grows organically can be represented at this historic market.
I know their growing season's a little bit different, but what were the conditions like when you were down there?
Oh, well, they're ending the rainy season, and we did get some rain, which was unseasonable in the dry season. We were eating things like different types of bananas. There was a little bit of star fruit, lots of greens in the Vega. We have a lot of greens at our course, which is kind of uncharacteristic for Belize. One really interesting thing was I met with someone from one of the larger resorts who caters to North Americans, and he was talking about how all the trouble he goes to with growing North American vegetables. He actually has a whole cooler that's dedicated, a whole refrigerator that's dedicated to starting seeds.
Wow. So coming back up to Portland, so when we talked in February, we had been hit with snow, and it feels like the last couple of days have been sort of the opposite. They've been sunny and pleasant. How are you responding to this weather that we're having?
Well, it's that teaser we usually get in March where it gets really warm and people think they can plant stuff that they can't necessarily plant yet. So the most important thing when choosing what you can do in the garden is to look at your air temperatures and your soil temperatures, and they really tell us where we're at. I've heard that there's some prediction that we might have snow again in the next week. I do know that when I looked at the weather, I saw some lows in the 33 or something one night. And so even though we're getting warm during the day, we're lacking that cloud cover, which makes our warm days also cold at night.
So then I want to look to the kind of the weather of the future. What are some of the challenges that we still have to face coming up in the season?
I think that's the biggest challenge. You know, as we look at last year when we had a really cold May and people were selling tomato plants before it was even warm enough to plant tomato plants outside, I think that keeping in mind that even though like we might get a stretch of really warm days, that it's going to get cold again. And just holding back and trying to keep seasonal. You know, one of the things that climate change is, how climate change is affecting places all over the world is that we have bigger swings in our weather. So in Belize, we are seeing that we got some rainstorms that were unseasonable for the dry season. And likewise, we've got to watch for that unpredictable weather that's going to affect our crops. I think another thing to watch for is that our rain has been getting more, it seems like the raindrops are fall harder than they used to, and that can cause a lot of compaction on the soil. So taking care to protect your soil, don't walk on your garden beds, make sure beds are mulched, and then when you're ready for planting, rake back that mulch so the soil can warm up.
Well, that's a great transition to talk about soil. We oftentimes talk about soil building and compost on this show. What can folks be doing right now to improve their soil?
Well, now is the time that we want to lime our soil to sweeten it up and make it a little less acidic after all the rains that we had over the winter. It's a good time to add any of those slow-release nutrients. But gathering things for composting, as we get that warm weather, we're going to see a lush growth of grass and people are going to start mowing their lawns. And that's one of the best materials to be able to bulk out your compost pile and get it up to a really good temperature so you can actually compost weeds and other things that need to be at a high temp to safely break down and transition into that nourishing, wonderful stuff that we add to for our soil fertility.
And then as we're composting, as we're adding the lime to the soil, it's important that if we're not planting in it immediately, we cover it back up.
Absolutely. Yeah. Don't add lime on your soil on a sunny day. It can actually damage the soil if the lime sits in the sun.
So you talk about that we're in this phase that's sort of a tease. We have sunny days. We want to plant. So then are there varieties that we can start seeding right now?
Absolutely. We're starting to be able to plant our cool season vegetables. I had my peas in last month, so peas can definitely go in. Potatoes can go in. People can direct sow beets and carrots and radishes and parsnips, turnips as well. All of those I recommend that you direct sow because they're root crops, so they dislike transplanting. We can also start planting some of the greens like lettuces and arugula and mizuna, transplant and starting all of the brassica starts as well. I prefer to plant these tender greens indoors in a pot and then transfer them out once I have a sizable start. And that's just because the slugs are still out right now and they love to eat those tender greens as much as we do.
So to help some of the seeds, you know, grow, what are some things that we can do as far as like covering or what are some things that we can do to encourage the seeds to germinate and grow?
If you're planting directly in the ground outside?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, keeping it moist and making sure that we keep that in mind, since sometimes these springs in the last couple of years haven't been as wet as they used to be. It used to be that we didn't have to monitor for moisture as much as we do now. So carrots like to be kept damp for 10 days before they germinate. So a warm day like yesterday might dry out your carrot seeds. You could also cover them with some Rime or something to prevent birds from getting them. I usually put out some of those shiny pinwheels to prevent birds from coming and eating my seedlings.
And then what are some of the things that we should be holding off on right now? What should we hit the pause button on for
planting? Any of the warm season stuff. Those were waiting till May. So that'll be tomatoes, peppers. I mean, they're not going to be ready yet, but they might start to be ready, you know, before we meet again in April. Yeah. So I'd hold off on those. Cucumbers, beans, squash, all of those need at least 50 degrees at night before we plant them in the garden.
All right, and so we have nice days where, you know, you want to get out, you want to do some bed prep. What are some notes that you have for folks that want to get out and start preparing their beds now?
It's a great time to prepare your beds. It's a great time for pulling weeds. There's some weeds that are starting to flower and go to seed, and that's the best time to get them is right before they flower. Make sure you get them out by the roots so you can remove them completely. If you weed your garden and you plan to plant later, you could take care to mulch it. I think it's a great time for defining your paths, for putting in beds if you're going to put in more beds, building the compost pile, as we mentioned, and transplanting any perennials that can be divided and spread around the garden. This is the perfect time for moving about all of those plants. It's also a good time for planting fruit trees and berry bushes.
And then if we do get out and are able to prep a bed that we don't plant immediately, you know, what do we do?
I like to let a bed sit for about 1 to 3 weeks before planting. I top dress with compost, and that gives enough time for the soil food web to be able to work in the compost. All of those arthropods that live in the soil like to, they will do the tilling for you, and they'll move that compost deeper in the soil for your plants.
So we haven't talked about perennials in a while, and I wanted to check in. Is there anything we can be doing this time of year for berries or fruit trees?
Yeah, now's a great time for thinning our berries. So pruning has been completed, hopefully, because now everything's leafing out. The berries and the fruit trees, the plums are looking glorious right now in bloom. It's important to thin your raspberries, which is a really common crop for everyone to be growing. But we need to be able to thin them so we have one plant about every foot or so. When the raspberries get too dense, then it encourages the spotted wing Drosophila, which is one of our most frequent pests in the gardens this time. It really likes soft fruit, and it's the one that nests, that lays an egg in your berry, and when you go to eat it, if it's overripe, it'll kind of just melt in your hand.
And then as we're looking down the road with our perennials, what are some of the, you know, we can thin now, but what are some of the things that we can do to guarantee that we're going to have a good harvest later in the season?
Top dress with compost. That's always a good thing. And then once you've done that, then mulching them to make sure that they that you're discouraging weed competition.
And then being patient until the next time you can prune and the cycle returns.
Yeah, and for things that are we're growing for their flowers, you know, we can cut flowers to encourage more blooms.
Great. So what classes or events do you have coming up in the near future?
I've got quite a number of things coming up. This Saturday, I'm offering an introduction to permaculture that's sponsored by the Hardy Plant Society of Oregon. A week from Saturday, there's going to be a day-long workshop with the conservation district that focuses on soil. It's called Soil School, and it's at the Rock Creek Center. The next workshop in my Grow Your Own Produce workshop series is on Tuesday, April 10th. And I'm still taking registration. I have a few spots left for people that want to sign up for my Vegetable Starts CSA program. And I did quite well with having my vegetable starts be tended to while I was in Belize. So I'm expecting that I'll have my first plant sale potentially even this weekend, but within the next couple weeks. And my subscribers will get their first flat of vegetable starts for the year within the next 2 weeks.
Great. Thanks, Marisha, so much for coming on, for giving us the needed garden advice. It's speeding up.
Yeah. Thanks, Chris. One more thing we should add is that all of those events, if people are interested in more information can be found on my website at permaculturerising.com.
Great. Thanks, Marisha.
Thanks, Chris.
That was Marisha Auerbach, and you're listening to The Food Show on KBOO. In a moment, I'll be talking with food system and community activist Nikki Silvestri. Stay with us.
True, it's a dance we know the moves, the bow, the dip, the woo. The words are true. The state is old news. Wrap me in your arms. I can't feel it burn. Wrap me in your arms. I can't feel it burn. Get up, get down. Get up, get down. Feel the rotation start. See the next one wake. Get up, get down. Get up, get down. Get up. Sentiments are singing with a pair of feet change. I know my words will dry up on the skin. Just like a name I remember hearing. Wild winter. Warm coffee, mom's gone. Do you love me? Blazing summer, cold coffee, baby's gone. Do you love me? Wrap me in your arms. I can feel it burn. Rock me in your arms. I can't feel it burn. Get up, get down. Get up, get down. Feel the generation and start. See the next one waking. Get up, get down. Get up, get down. Get up. Sitting in the same with a pair of feet change. Get up, get down. Get up, get down. Get up, get down. Get up, get down. Get up. Sentiments seem to perfect change.
You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO. I'm Chris Siegel. Every once in a while, I like to go back into the archives and pull out conversations that inspired me. One of the best conversations I've had since hosting The Food Show was with activist and community organizer Nikki Silvestri. Nikki has a fresh approach to increasing equity within the food system. She works to grow and strengthen relationships within communities and focuses on elevating voices of populations who are underrepresented. Here's that conversation with Nikki Silvestri. You love soil. You say you're a self-proclaimed soil geek. What's the connection between soil and social justice?
Everything. I mean, being a Black studies person, I can't really think about the beginning of social injustice in this country without thinking about land use and the working of the soil in particular, and how to develop a labor source that could work the soil in a way that would be economically beneficial for the gross domestic product. So that's really the connection, is the beginning of this country and the way that land use over time and the way soil is used exploits people. And so if we can start there and pull that thread to what's happening modern day around food, fiber, and every other resource that comes out of the soil, then we have a place to move forward.
I guess it seems like your work is at the intersections of a lot of different kind of aspects of life, the environment, social dynamics, social justice. You talk about carbon sequestration, and you do it in a very poetic way, talking about that intersection. Could you tell us a little bit more about what your thoughts on carbon sequestration?
One thing I love about carbon sequestration is that it actually really is complex, right? You've got Ohio State University that has all of these studies about exactly how much carbon we can sequester from the atmosphere and put it back in the soil. And that's completely dependent on different geographies. That's dependent upon the techniques used. It doesn't stay in the soil forever. So really, carbon sequestration for me is a piece of increasing the pace of the carbon cycle. And carbon at this point is just stuck in a bunch of different places and it's not cycling anywhere, which is why it's having detrimental effects on us. And so what I like to think about there is just how do we create the circumstances to make sure carbon's moving quickly.
Wow.
So this is a kind of a large question, but what is a just food system?
A just food system is one that meets the needs of all the stakeholders in the food system. And so when I think about sustainability and ecology, economy, and equity, on the ecology side, it's seeing just as being for all beings, flora and fauna. And when it comes to economy, I see just as being livelihoods being cared for, so that all people who are working in that food system or who are consuming from that food system feel like they are being fully used for their crafts. And then on the equity side, that's making sure that everyone feels their place.
So I want to talk a little bit about the ways to actually connect and bring people together in the food world who are doing like organics, who are, you know, creating community-based like farmers markets, connecting the people who are working in the movement, who are predominantly, I mean, I don't want to discount the work of like of people of color, but there's this one world where it's predominantly white people working with white people, and then there's this other world where underserved people are not getting the attention, or I mean by definition they're underserved.
Right.
What does it mean to kind of connect those spaces in those worlds?
It means having an understanding of systemic and institutional discrimination and being able to rectify that economically. There are some very simple, I feel like any practitioners of the food system kind of understand the way that the Farm Bill subsidizes not specialty crops, they subsidize commodity crops. And there are things like that all over the place, how hard it is for farmers to get crop insurance if they want to actually start building healthy soil. There's so many really tangible, concrete things around systemic discrimination of good practices, and rectifying that and knowing that it's going to be really hard and that commitment is necessary to follow it through, and that it's going to be maybe more pain provoking in the short term than we would like, is really necessary.
This is getting into you as the activist, as the change maker. How are you not crippled by massive systems that seemingly are working against you?
Personally? Wow. I talk to like five people on a regular basis, and I live in the trees. And neither of those things were things I thought I would ever be. But I had to just acknowledge who I am. And I process a lot of grief on a daily basis. And so my reflective practice and being able to have the tools to process that much grief and see that relationship to joy on the other end when grief is moving and it's not stuck is really necessary. And that's actually something that I would advise for most people right now, is becoming grief processing factories so that we don't have to ignore all of the craziness that's happening right now, but we also don't have to let that cripple us.
Yeah, you talk about this, especially with leaders, how leaders need to sort of integrate or come to terms, have that kind of inner practice that deals with the pain that they carry with them, that they can then, you know, process it and share their experience authentically with the world. Yeah, I think it's not a question.
Yes. One thing I would say here, this is another reason why ecosystems are so inspiring to me. Biomimicry is one of my favorite things ever. And I feel like, you know, the pain of when a tree dies, knowing how many habitats died with it, there is, and knowing that trees are so intelligent and they love so deeply, there's a way that then that process of decay and reincorporation is its own, there's beauty there, but it's painful beauty, and it doesn't smell good, and it doesn't feel good a lot of times, but it's still beautiful. And I feel like in ecosystems, we have precedents for things that we don't do en masse socially.
Yeah, I guess you're kind of talking about the evolution of, like, where destruction happens, there's also going to be creation. I mean, when those ecosystems get destroyed, those habitats get destroyed, when that tree is now on the ground, it's also now creating new ecosystems and new habitats that maybe weren't what you originally thought was intended for the tree. That kind of gets me to this idea, these three words that you've been kicking around: resist, insist, love, as kind of your approach to I don't know, social justice, to life, to, like, working with people. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. Me and a couple of friends of mine were kicking around the idea of resist, insist, love, because there's so much resistance happening right now. And it connects to me to the cycle of creation, sustaining, and destruction. That the reminder that it's a cycle, and that destruction tends to be one of the hardest parts for us, is what keeps us going. And remembering that love, as a part of that cycle, as the sustenance component of life, is non-negotiable.
So you're catching me in the middle of my journey. One of the things I struggle with is wanting to empathize and understand the Black experience while not trying to make every, you know, Black person I run into an ambassador for the Black experience, for Black people. But you put yourself in the position where you're in a room full of predominantly white people, it seems like, regularly. So how do you deal with that? Like, how do you approach that? How do you make that work?
My spiritual practice is about non-dualism. And so it's always both. And in that sense, it is hard to be the only one in the room. And so my grounding with my family, which is super, super Black. When I say my family is super Black, I mean super Black. And we are in deep touch and super close. So I feel like my foundation of my people is well held. And on the other hand, we're all just humans. And I feel like I have a really deep practice as well of just meeting every individual where they are and remembering that race is a social construction. But neither one of those is more or less significant to me. They're both equally as true. And it's a very intense dynamic tension to carry at the same time. So in my practice, I learn how to hold polarities at the same time, and that helps.
I think I either read this about you or heard you say it. I'm not sure the source, but the idea of wearing different skins in order to authentically connect with people, it's interesting because you say wearing different skins versus wearing different hats. You know, I think, like, hats are pretty neutral, but skin is, like, that's you. That's a part of you. Could you talk a little bit more about that, like this idea of authentically connecting with many different people?
Yeah, well, that's fundamental to organizing, and it's fundamental to the kind of, if we're looking for real economic change, that requires compromise and governance. And right now, government and governance have kind of become separate things, unfortunately. But governance requires a deep interrogation of what we hold dear and what we're willing to sacrifice and compromise of that. And the ability to see ourselves in other people is key to the ability to compromise and thus the ability to govern. And so I feel like we're entering a time where we can't leave governance to anyone but ourselves. And we all have to have that skill.
You recently rebranded your firm from Silvestri Strategies to Soil and Shadow. Tell me about that process of kind of changing the image of what you're trying to do.
Well, Soil and Shadow came from this process of me really wanting to know where I'm putting my foot down in the world. And they're both such beautiful words, and I think that they both reflect the foundational message of what I carry, of building fertility in systems is about strengthening the connections between everything and strengthening the complexity of relationships. And so in soil fertility, that feels pretty clear. And focusing on soil fertility in ecosystems management helps to impact everything else and can be economically viable. And so that's what I carry on that side. And on the shadow side, increasing the complexity of relationships between people is rocket science. It's simple, but it's very hard to do. And so talking about social fertility on that side means that it grounds the message of sustainability to me in the fact that it's not going to be easy, and it's going to be really rewarding, and it's going to take vulnerability and courage.
Now, you mentioned this a little bit in your keynote, but I kind of want to finish kind of on the uplifting note, like the work that's being done in this world that's really exciting, that's like change-making, that's bringing people together, you know, over this divisiveness that's being created. Could you tell us what's exciting you? What are you seeing around you that is giving you hope?
Well, that's what I focus on in my work, that there are always people that have been trying to do the right thing forever, but doing the right thing and working at the intersections and doing work that's not sexy, quote unquote, is not well resourced because the media doesn't talk about it. And we hold extremes and polarities much easier than we do things that are governing and compromising because, you know, we like drama because we're human. So a lot of my work reinforces the beauty of the things that are in the middle, that are at the intersections, that are already doing all the right things, that are just in need of investment. So almost everyone I touch inspires me now.
Nikki, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
That was Nikki Silvestri, food systems activist and founder of Soil and Shadow. And that's it for this episode of The Food Show. If you missed any of the show or want to listen back, you can find the episode archived on the KBOO website at kbu.fm. I want to thank our guests, Lola and David Milholland, Rachel Mamane, Nikki Silvestri, and Marisha Auerbach, for being on today's show. I also want to thank our awesome engineer, Tammy. Stay with KBOO this afternoon, starting with Jazz Lives. And don't forget to tune in again next month on the third Wednesday of April for another episode of The Food Show. Until then, I'm Chris Siegel. Thanks for listening. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away just because it ain't the right size or perfect, cause you can't turn a fast dollar that way. You know it ain't right to make people grow coffee when their families could be growing food, working those lands for corporations. Don't do hungry people no good, cause people need food in their belly. Need some drink for the dry in their throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. People got to have food in their belly. Need some drink for the dry in their throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same. Trees.
hold the top saw, and those burgers aren't fit to eat. And you know it ain't right to punish the farmers for growing food clean and poison free. There ought to be a government who protect them, put tax dollars where they need to be. 'Cause people need food in their belly, they need some drink for the dry in their throat, they need for the world. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Got to have food in their belly. Need some drink for the dry in their throat. They need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Finance Committee will meet this month on March 22nd at 4:30.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Sister Spirits Pagan Fair 2018.